We're here in 3345 Power Street with Dudley Edwards, and just seeing his artwork, it's excellent stuff. Would you like to tell us a bit about it?
Sure, it's an exhibition of the work that I did in the 60s, and it's really been put together by Dave and Richard McTeague, and really they came to me because they were a fan of the work and said they'd like to. Was on a show in Liverpool, and I was happy to oblige. Really, just it was just most of the work was just sitting in a plant chest, not seeing the light of day. So it's nice to get it out there. So,
yeah. So it's really all it's usually all photographs of work that what they call the psychedelic artwork that was mainly in London, Carnaby Street, King Street, and yeah. King Street or King's Road.
Yeah, most of the work we did in the 60s then, what wasn't what you'd call psychedelic art, it was pre-psychedelic. And our main influence was fairground imagery. That's mainly because the I first came to music, I suppose, like lots of people did at that time, it was through the 50s with the rock and roll, with Bill Haley and all the American stuff that was coming over. And we couldn't get to hear any of that music other than on your little dance set record player or something, and there were no big stadium concerts in those days or what have you, so the only way to kind of hear it on a louder fashion which it suited was to go to the fairgrounds, which was an annual event.
Right.
And if you lived in a small city like Halifax or wherever, not like Liverpool, it was a major event when the fairground came to town.
So you grew up in Halifax?
Yeah. And you know, if you wanted to hear like Little Richard at full blast, however many decibels, then you'd go to the waltzes and enjoy yourself at the fairground. So the imagery, the fairground imagery, and our first experience of good music that was ours, the music for the youth, was intrinsically bound together, that kind of imagery and the music. So we wanted to kind of perpetrate that, especially when we come down from leaving art college in Bradford to come down to London, and it was kind of like a dirty grey city and everything, and we just wanted to bring colour to everything.
So did you go to London specifically to work on those things? Or?
Not specifically. I mean, we took a flat together. We went down there initially as students, having left Bradford College. It was Doug Binder, Dave Vaughan and myself. And we got a studio in Camden Town on Chalk Farm, and we couldn't afford to furnish the place, so we had two chairs and the chest of drawers.
Right.
And we thought, well, we sat there in this empty room, barring these three items of furniture, and we thought, well, we might as well paint them bright colours, at least brighten the place up, you know, cheer ourselves up, if anything.
I remember those days, yeah. Pre-Magnolia.
Yeah. So we painted these things, and after we painted them, we thought, wow, you know, like, other people might want these, you know. And the first thing we did was Chalk Farm was then an up and coming area, and David Bailey had moved into the area. His studio was right opposite our studio, and we used to sort of look with envy out the window as he drove, always driving in his up and top Mercedes full of these glamorous young models and everything. And so naively we just thought, well, if we put the chest of drawers outside his doorstep in the middle of the night, it's going to be the first thing he sees in the morning. He's bound to want it, you know. You know, typical northern naiveness, you know. And sure enough, that's what happened. And the cleaner came across and said, "David's left a check for you if you want to go and collect it." You know. But we're all nervous about going across, so we drew straws, and I got the short straw, and I went over there. And who opened the door but Catherine Deneuve, his then wife, who, you know, and my jaw dropped, you know, and she was in the negligee, and I thought this is just like so many French films I've seen her in, and I thought, like, this is going to be a ménage à trois, this is where we're going to finish up, you know, the three of us together, David Bailey, myself and Catherine Deneuve.
We're getting into fantasy land now.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, she, you know, no, you know, she gave me a cheque and that was it, the door closed and that was the end of that dream, you know. So, you know, say life doesn't imitate art, you know. But it got us off, you know, on the first step of the ladder. So, and from then on we started doing shop fronts. We wanted to paint everything, really. We haven't got any notion of we must paint this, we must paint that, which anything and everything. And so we did the front of Wolf Olin's graphic studio. I don't know if you know, they did all the British Airways livery and ICI, a major, now a major graphic design company, but they weren't at the time. We did their front, and then we thought we'd fancy doing cars. And we thought, well, we can't expect anybody having paid a lot of money for a car to allow us just to be let loose with paintbrushes, you know. So we took the risk and we went to the bank to ask for a loan to buy a car to paint. And I think it was just, I think this is one of the reasons the swinging 60s happened, is because the money was plentiful at the time. The bank, we just told the bank manager what we wanted to do. We'd got no collateral. And he gave us £2,000 or £3,000 just to do it.
Could you drive?
I couldn't. Dave could, you know. But the no questions asked. I mean, you know, an equivalent amount of money these days, you know, you have to remortgage the house, whatever. But no, the money was there. So we bought a car, painted our own car as an example, and then hoping that people would then want theirs doing. And first person to respond was Tara Brown, who was the heir to the Guinness fortune. He wanted his AC Cobra doing. And he was a close friend of Paul McCartney's, so that's how he made the introduction, so that's how we got to do Paul's piano. And then we also did a kind of, we then started putting on light shows too, and we got a guy over from San Francisco, because light shows weren't that big in this country at that time. And we hadn't got a clue how to really go about it, but we knew we wanted to do it. And we got this guy who did the Fillmore and the Avalon in San Francisco to come over and show us how to go about it. And we put on a big light show called the Festival of Light at the Roundhouse. And Paul did this electronic tape for us, which is the longest track that the Beatles ever produced, and it's about 15 minutes long.
But that's not been released, is that
it's not been released, no. And but there was also on that same track, Paul had left his kind of he was playing around with that song Fixing a Hole When the Rain Gets In.
Yeah.
And he left that on the same tape. I don't think he meant to, and we didn't know because we didn't run through the tape before. And Paul turned up on the night. I think he was a bit angry at the time because you know, anybody could have bootlegged it. Luckily, they didn't. But it was pre-release of Sgt. Pepper, you know. And, but we weren't to know. We just put the tape on and let it run, you know.
Those light shows were the very basic, like oil and colour things, or overhead projectors?
Yeah, oil and glycerine lights. And various colours, and we used the clock faces from Grandfather Clocks for me to rock those together on top of the overhead projectors and things. But we coated the whole of the round at the inside of the roundhouse with white sheeting, so it's done on a large scale. It was the first big event light show, you know. So that was terrific, and we got Hendrix to play on the second day. In fact, when he came to, that was one of those accidental things, because we went to see T2 Burns, who was the impresario for all the major acts at that time. And he said that we wanted a biggish name, and he said, he offered somebody, I can't remember who it was now, but we said, well, that's a bit steep, you know, price-wise. And he said, well, I'll let you have them at a knockdown price if you take this young boy who's only 50 quid.
Right.
You know, and we said, well, we can't be much, we were sort of discussing it amongst ourselves and said, he can't be much good if he's only £50, you know.
Right.
Anyway, we said, go on then, we'll take him. That turned out to be Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
And he turned up, he already had a following. He turned up, and there was about 2,000 people came just to listen to him. So Tito Burns, who was big impresario, obviously he wasn't aware of everything that was under his stable at the time, you know.
So.
And you did light shows for Floyd as well?
No. Only, I mean, we did light shows at the Alexander Palace gig, along with Yoko Ono and one or two other people, Mark Boyle and one or two others. But there were 40 groups there, one of which was Pink Floyd, so I wouldn't say we actually worked with Pink Floyd as such, you know.
Yeah, I went to the Roundhouse a couple of years later.
Oh, right, yeah.
Incredible string band.
Oh, yeah, I saw them many a time. Yeah, in fact, I used to go out with Mouse, who was one of the girls
used to go
with them. Yeah.
So the, all the artwork here is from 1967, that era,
yeah.
68 maybe. But moving on, you've been working, you didn't stop working in 68, you didn't work
in 68. Following, after we'd done the light shows, yeah. we kind of like, we were getting too heavily into the drug thing and everything was falling apart.
Right.
And we couldn't coordinate anything anymore and it was hitting some of us worse than others. And I finished up homeless at the time, and then Paul got in touch and said, are you doing anything, you know, and I said, nothing at all, you know, and he said, well, would you like to come and paint a mural in my house, you know. So I went over to live with him for a while and painted the mural in his house. Went to the recordings at Abbey Road for Sergeant Pepper and various things, and went socialising and what have you. We had a great time, and then when Jane Asher came back from America, because she was on a theatrical tour or something, he told me, well, Ringo wants a mural painted in his place. So I went over to Weybridge to live with Ringo for a while and paint one there, you know. And so that was all kind of really great.
He's a good friend to have, isn't he, Macca?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were all smashing lads, you know. And I went from there, I went into partnership with Mike McKinnon, he was the art editor of Hit magazine.
Right.
And we went into partnership doing psychedelic posts and things, and that's when the work I was doing changed from being the fairground Igloo stuff, then it became psychedelic. So it's more cerebral and more narrative based, or what have you. And we were living in the middle of Shaftesbury Avenue at that point. So like anybody who came across to be interviewed by International Times finished up being invited around to Mike's place. And it got to the stage where it was like living in a bus shelter, you know, like just every American person of note used to come over and they'd call around to our place, and I thought we didn't have any privacy, you know.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where, towards the end, where I was going out to escape into the pub on an evening, you know, just to sit and drink on my own, you know. And I came back one night and I said, there was this guy talking in the corner and with a crowd of people around him. I thought, oh, I'm going to bed, you know, I went to bed. Next morning I woke up and I said to Mike, I said, who was the old guy talking in the corner last night? He said, oh, that was Buckminster Fuller. I thought, ah!
I'm sorry?
Buckminster Fuller.
Right.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, you know, like I'd have given anything to have been there, you know.
Yeah.
And a similar thing happened with Allen Ginsberg.
Right.
I slept through Allen Ginsberg too, you know.
Maybe it was his poetry, seriously.
Yeah. But I think it was also getting to Mike, and in the end we both decided to move out to Richmond.
Right.
And Mike was a close friend of Townsend, so we finished up doing things with Pete. And Pete asked me later on to do film various... first of all, he financed a film that I wanted to make. And then after that, he wanted to promote groups around the country. I mean, he's always been good that way, Pete. And he gave me the camera and everything else, and said, he said, go up to Liverpool, photograph any young up and coming groups, or film them, do a promo video for them, really on the cheaply so they could afford it. And that was the day we came up to do it, myself and Soundman. And that was the day Lennon got shot. And it was interesting because, I mean, I was sad because I met John. I didn't know him as well as Paul or Ringo, but it's interesting. I was driving around Liverpool that day with the radio on, you know, and listening to all the local phone-ins. And a lot of people were heartbroken, obviously, you know, asking for this number to be sung.
Yeah.
But there were other people phoning in saying, "Sirs, the bugger right, you should never have left Liverpool," you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't believe it, you know.
It's one of the bad...
Yeah.
That size of
it. And yet, you know, I mean, there were some of them, I mean, like Ringo, he was always homesick. He would come back to Liverpool every 3 or 4 weeks, you know, to see his parents and that, you know. Yeah. So they were never, far from Liverpool, whatever, you know. So, I mean, recent times, I'm now working on my own paintings. Nice. Got an exhibition coming up at Deanclough in Halifax in February. And Fender have asked me to do half a dozen customised guitars, so they're going to run with a limited edition or something.
Is your recent work, your recent paintings, not similar to the?
No, they're wanting the 60s style stuff on the guitars.
Right.
And the paintings, no, they're very different.
Yep, looks like landscapes of Halifax or something.
No, they're figurative mainly, but.
Oh yes.
Excuse me. But the. And I've also, you know, I've got a company with my wife, Madeline, who comes from Liverpool. She was brought up in Smithdown Road. She her parents run a paper shop there.
Right.
And we've got a company making rugs. And we've done those for musicians like Daniel Bedingfield, Tori Amos. Yeah, and the most recent one we did was Peter Gabriel.
Right.
We didn't meet the other two, but Peter, we'd been down to see him regular, and we get on really well with his smashing fella, yeah.
Right. And again,
different kind of imagery.
Subdued colours, not
no, these kind of like, we do carved rugs, and we do like labyrinths carved in the rugs, and crop circles, and various and snow tyre tracks in the snow and things. They're all very, very different again.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I think everybody was, you know, they were only about 40 or 50 people who were involved in the swinging 60s. Yeah. I know when they had the Summer of Love exhibition at the Tate, which I'd got some work in, and I turned up on the opening night and they were all there, and we all knew each other. And there's only like 40 or 50 people really in total.
Yeah.
And I think that's all it needs. I mean, I think that's the same with the, you know, the punk era or everything else, and it's people who say like, let's, you know, we're not relying on the man or the big businesses, we say we'll do it ourselves, you know. Yeah. I mean, I was a big admirer of the punk era, you know, although it was kind of anti-hippie in a sense, but I mean, I'm sure lots of hippies thought, good on you, you know, great stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I wasn't keen on most of the music, but
they were producing their own magazines, they weren't relying on big recording studios with 20 track or whatever, were they were sort of like and I thought, great stuff, yeah. So I think that's all you need is enough enthusiasm, enough young people with enough enthusiasm and to do their own thing and not rely on the big man, you know, and, you know, enough rebels.
Okay.
Thanks for downloading from DeafNet Media.